crew that has a physical layout that you like, that has a price that you like. And don't look at the gain number. In that particular case, the gain could really lead you astray. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the tech man.
Yeah, good information to remember also. Yeah, no, people don't know that. And they believe the advertiser because why would they lie? All right, let me drop and I'll come on to the next one. Quick science question.
The reason, let me drop. The reason they lie is because they can get away with it 99.9% of the time. How many people on planet Earth have the facility to really measure the absolute gain of a VHF, UHF antenna? To really do it traceable to the Bureau requires an extremely high performance anechoic chamber. How many people have access to an anechoic chamber where they could resolve the difference between a 1 dB antenna and a 2.2 dB gain antenna claim? How many people have that? They can claim anything they want because nobody can confirm it. Nobody has access to that anechoic chamber because an anechoic chamber costs a good fraction of a megabuck. And unless you're willing to pay some company to run a very expensive test, it's going to cost you $20,000 to run the test for a couple of days to confirm the difference between 1.0 and 2.2 dB of gain. Nobody's going to do that. And what many people will do is then go to a outside area test facility, an Oates range. The Oates range can easily have 5 decibels of error in the measurement because of the reflections off the ground and the reflections off the building of the Oates range. And you go to an Oates range and you go to a company that owns one of these and you do a test and they give you a great big data sheet and they claim it's traceable to the Bureau by the methods of measurement they use. Yes, they follow the procedure for an Oates range. And an Oates range is a antenna range of desperation because you have no other choice. If I'm going to measure a 300 megacycle antenna, it's got to be done on an outside area test set or on a reflective ground plane antenna range. And there's a whole art and science to properly set up one of those. And if you're not careful, you can come up with an 8 decibel error in your measurement. So because nobody can make the measurement, they can claim anything in the world.
Repeater, time out.
Because nobody can make the measurement, they can claim anything in the world and get away with it. And they've only been doing it for the last 20 years. The situation got so bad with amateur radio antennas that if you'll notice, every single one of the antenna advertisements in QST Magazine does not have a claim for gain. ARL will not allow you in their advertisement to put a gain number on the ad. For a damn good reason. They discovered a whole lot of years ago that 98% of those guys were lying through their teeth. They were claiming all kinds of numbers because they realized the average amateur is looking at decibels per dollar. As such, ARL will not allow you to put a gain number on that antenna, on that advertisement in their magazine. You could go to their ad on their website and read the gain number if you want to believe it. And in many cases, it's a lie by quite a number of decibels. So, gain of...
Right, how comfortable are you with the pack rats measuring and some of the other ones?
Where the amateur radio does a well-adjusted outdoor antenna range, particularly when it used to be done by the Central States, or by the East Coast VHF Society, where Dr. Dick Turin, W2IMU of Bell Laboratories, would show up, look over their shoulder and say, you better do this, you better do that, where you have the right people maintaining the antenna range. I believe those measurements are good to 1 dB and better at times. When it comes to Kent, WA5EJB, every one of the Central State VHF Society meetings, he's been making antenna gain measurements for 25, 30 years. By now, he's getting good at it. And by the way, you read any of his articles about circular polarized antennas, and man, what a nightmare that is. There's a hell of a lot of guys that build helical antennas, and they think they've got a zillion dB of gain and perfect circularity. And you get it on a real antenna range, and you make a measurement, and if the guy believes what he sees, he's going to have tears in his eyes, because the majority of the methods of construction of a helical antenna gives you something very different than the original design, if you know what I mean. So, a ground outdoor antenna range, a so-called reflective ground plane antenna range, done by the dip turn technique, W2IMU. You go to your AROL antenna book. You go to the chapter on transmission lines and antenna measurements. Why the hell they put the antenna measurement section on the back end of the chapter on transmission lines, I don't know. It's hidden in that book. But your antenna manual, you go to the right chapter, you go to the back of that chapter on transmission lines and antenna measurements. Let me drop. And you read and understand the test procedure by Dr. Dick Turin, W2IMU. You follow that procedure. You can get considerably better than 1 dB of accuracy, and if you do it carefully, you can probably get half a dB of accuracy. You go the next step beyond that, and you use the ratiometry antenna range technique by K2RIW, which was February 1977, QST Magazine. I think it was the March issue. The ratiometry antenna range technique, which is now being used by the Rome Air Development Center, arguably one of the best antenna ranges on planet Earth, outdoor antenna ranges. You use those procedures, you can get repeatability of a 20th of a dB. You can get accuracy better than half a dB on an outdoor antenna range if you know what you're doing. I didn't say it's easy, but the pitfalls there are described in those articles. You might have some further questions on this one, Barry. N2 Moonbound, K2LIW in the second half.
On the first question, you answered them all, Jacob. You usually do.
Hey, Barry, are you telling me that this guy, RIW, is very verbose? He's talking all the time. Is that what you're telling me, Barry?
Very well versed in antennas, though. In fact, I'm using one right now.
Yeah, but the game claim of that antenna, Barry, was set in the advertising department, not in the measurement laboratory. I'm joshing you. I'm kidding with you, Barry. So, John, antenna measurements, particularly on an outdoor antenna range, that's an art form. It's a minefield. There's only 50 ways you can go wrong, and you can be honest as all hell, and you think you're doing it just right, and you're getting an answer with, let me pick a number, 8 decibels of error, and you think it's traceable to the Bureau because you've done everything right, and you're using calibrated test equipment, and the test equipment is gold-plated. When it comes to an outdoor antenna range, there's only 50 ways you can go wrong. But you read those articles that I just mentioned to you, and you can make it a hell of a lot righter than wronger, if you know what I mean. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the tech man.
KC2WGB. Very well, Jacob. Yep, sounds like good information. Also, it's a lot easier if he builds an antenna and it works better than the one he had previous. He's on the right track. I am sure you'll agree with that. So, he just has to keep building. Let me let him drop my glove.
KC2QAQ. Glenn recognized. You want to add something to this? To this tirade of mine, Glenn, go ahead.
Actually, I never made the calibrated measurement stick, but I did do a couple of reference measurements of one antenna to another on some more than 2 meters, 70-centimeter antennas inside a G10. And I was wondering what you think of using that as from a reference antenna to other antennas, kind of like doing an AB challenge, so to speak.
Yes, Glenn and I and a few other guys, Charlie, WB2HMM, house-mounted mobile, Charlie Rankin, the three of us have used G10. What a G10 looks like is a huge horn antenna, is what it looks like from the side view. One end of the horn tapers down to a very narrow device where you got a waveguide to coax adapter, and you got a tight-end connector, and you connect to the instrumentation to the right-hand end of this thing. The left-hand end of this thing, which is about 15 feet long, ends up with a great big horn-like device where the output end of this horn is almost a 10-foot square. But the end of the horn is not open to the world. It's got a built-in huge 50-ohm resistor inside of the end of this thing. And there's a piece of metal going down the center of it. So by putting the right amount of voltage on that piece of metal, that piece of sheet metal that goes down the center, and you know the number of meters between that piece of sheet metal and the outer dimensions of this horn, you now know exactly how many volts per meter you're exposing your piece of electronics to. The main intention of a G10 is to pick up, is to take your piece of electronics and each one of the frequencies you care about, maybe you're going to sweep from 10 megacycles to 1,000 megacycles, and you're going to keep the voltage 10 volts per meter, 100 volts per meter, 3 volts per meter, whatever, by putting the right amount of voltage on the sheet metal going down the center, by putting your device of the test in the right position near the load end of this G10 light device. You got a great big door on the side with a bunch of finger stock around the door. You open that door, you put in your device of the test on a insulated table, probably made out of micotter or made out of plexiglass or fiberglass. You close the door, you turn on the instrumentation, you turn on your thing on the test, and you find out what you're seeing. And you find out whether or not it has susceptibility to that number of volts per meter. So when it comes to applying volts per meter into a device on the test, the G10 does a beautiful job. When it comes to using it in reverse to find out what is the radiated volts per meter out of your device on the test, and you put the device on the test right side up, upside down, you rotate it around the X, Y, and Z axis, and you find out what is the susceptibility and what its emission is in volts per meter of emission, of radiated emission. When it comes to that kind of testing, the G10 is a beautiful device. When it comes to measuring an antenna, I don't think so. Because an antenna only is an antenna if it's in free space. It has to see 377 ohms, pure air or pure vacuum in all dimensions of space around the antenna for the antenna to behave correctly. You put it inside of a G10, it's in a metallic chamber with all kinds of reflections of the back lobes, the side lobes, and everything else coming out of the antenna. You could put an antenna in there and put power into the antenna and find out if it gets hot and measure whether or not the antenna has got a certain amount of efficiency. Now, even that you can't do because the metallic structure around it is changing the impedance of the antenna, and therefore an antenna that was perfectly tuned before is now not perfectly tuned. So can you use a G10 for measuring the gain difference of very low gain antennas, dipole-like? Maybe. But a real Yagi antenna, you put it into a G10, no way, Jose. Those are my opinions on that. Very strongly felt opinions, as you can tell, they got KC2QIQ, K2LIW in the tech net.
Yeah, I kind of agree, Dick. I came up with some interesting results, and but how I actually performed that test was I took a very weak signal, like a 0 dBm signal, and fed it into the end of the G10. So in other words, I was driving the signal from the end of the G10, and then using the antenna with feed line cable going through one of the insulated feed-throughs that come through the side of the chamber, and I connected the spectrum analyzer over there, and basically looked at, in different axes for polarization. And what was kind of interesting that I found very, very interesting in the results from the G10, what it pointed out was that many of the antennas that I put in there, whether they were quarter wave, half wave, 5/8 wave and width antennas for 2 meter and 70 centimeter, that the gain that I saw didn't really change very much at all, if anything. But what did change was there were radical differences in the antenna with polarization. In other words, whether it was vertical, horizontal, or off to the side, the higher the wavelength of the antenna, in other words, the difference between, say, half wave, 5/8 wave versus a quarter wave, was the polarization was much sharper, Dick. That's what I had seen, at least anyway. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Hey, let me go to the next step and give you a little bit more function of what's going on here. Every antenna that you and I test, Glenn and John and Barry and so on, has something that's called a near-field range. You can calculate the near-field range of your antenna by plugging in the formula 2D squared of a lambda. In other words, if you know the equivalent diameter, physical diameter of the antenna, in the case of a feed on or in the case of a parabolic dish, knowing the diameter of the antenna is very easy. You can measure it with your ruler. In the case of a Yagi antenna, the diameter we're talking about now is the effective capture area diameter. And that's a little bit more complicated. You got to know what you intend to have as the gain of the antenna. Gain is 4 pi a over lambda squared. Area is gain lambda squared over 4 pi. You solve the formula for area. You know what the area of the antenna has to be if it really has that gain. And now once you know that diameter that would give you that area, assume it's a circle, as long as the metallic structure of your testing fixture, G-chem or whatever, is, let me pick a number, 2 or 3 times the near field range. If your particular 900 meg antenna has a calculated near field range of 6 inches, and it might really be that number, and if the nearest metallic structure in that G-chem is not 6 inches, but 18 inches away in all directions, in that particular case, the dipole of that 900 meg example antenna I'm using will think it's in free space. As long as the metallic structures are 2 or 3 times the near field range away from the antenna, now you can test that antenna inside of the GTEM. But you take a Yagi antenna on 2 meters, which has an effective capture area of a 12-foot diameter circle, and you put it into a GTEM on the drop. You put that Yagi antenna I just described on 2 meters. It probably is a 5-element Yagi. It's probably on a 10-foot boom. And even if it squeezes into the chamber, it's got an effective capture area of a 12-foot diameter circle. And you put it into that G-10 where the nearest metallic walls are 1.5 feet away in X, Y, and Z. You don't have an antenna anymore. The near field loading you've done with metallic structures to that antenna means that whatever VisWire you measured is out the window. Whatever efficiency you measured is out the window. Whatever gain you measured is not even on this planet. So, can you put an antenna in a G-temp? There's a yes and a no. If the frequency is high enough, the wavelength is long and low enough in meters, and the gain is low enough so that you're far outside of its near field range, when you put it in the G-temp, yes, you can measure its gain, its polarization, you can measure everything about it. But if you're violating the near field range of your antenna by getting even within a 2-to-1 ratio of the near field range, you don't have an antenna anymore. You've disturbed the living daylights out of it, and you've contaminated the antenna, and whatever you measure has no real meaning. You see where I'm going on that one, Glenn. KC2QIQ, KQLIW in the tech man.
Yeah, I sure do, Dick. I think also the other claim, I think, with a lot of these companies where they talk about, like, say, not a Yagi, but, like, say, mobile antennas, that there's a certain amount of sharpness to the takeoff angle of the antenna, and they try to use that or squeeze that into part of their gain relationship that probably is more of a further, in other words, you need a lot more distance to really see that, where I was maybe, 10 feet or maybe a little bit more from the generator source inside the chamber. I didn't really see much of a change in the gain, but I could see the difference in the sharpness of the polarization. But I was just wondering if you had a comment about that, being that these were mobile whip antennas, and they were certainly far enough away from the side of the chamber to meet that criteria, I believe. But I didn't see the difference in the gain between the antennas. KC2QIQ.
If I go into a great big parking lot and I've got a Volkswagen automobile and a great big, a Ford station wagon, and I take a 5/8 wave mag mount antenna and put it in the middle of the roof of that station wagon, and take the exact same mag mount antenna and put it in the middle of the roof of the Volkswagen, and now I'm measuring exact field strength coming from a repeater that's a long distance away. I've got a field strength meter doing reception inside the automobile as I drive a circle pattern in that parking lot. I will see significant differences. The exact same mag mount 5/8 wave antenna mounted on 2 different vehicles are going to give me significantly different performance. Particularly if I mounted the 5/8 wave on the left-hand rear corner of the vehicle, like mounting it to the bumper, because a mobile antenna mounted on an automobile, Even though the antenna itself in free space is omnidirectional, you mount it on the bumper of a car, it develops an extremely directional pattern where the main lobe of transmitting tends to be in the direction of the major mass of the center of the car. If I mount it on the rear left-hand bumper of the car, I'm going to get the stronger signal near the towards the right-hand forward bumper of the car. In that direction is where the strongest signal is going to be. If I put it on a big car versus a small car, if I put it on a car that's got a fiberglass roof versus a metal roof, you can get huge differences of the exact same antenna mounted on two different automobiles. You could if you want to. I believe that the Underwriters Laboratory in one of the places on Long Island has a great big chamber where you can put the whole darn automobile in the chamber. The chamber walls are made out of this very exotic mag ram. In other words, the walls are aligned with this absorber. Let me drop it. Where these very expensive blocks of absorber on the walls have a combination of carbon granules and metallic granules that mean that has the right ratio that equals a lossy 377 ohm impedance absorber. So you've got these very fancy tiles, very expensive tiles on the wall of this chamber. You put the whole darn automobile in the middle of this chamber, and it's on a turntable. You mount your antenna on that automobile, and you rotate the automobile, and you start making measurements. That's about the only way you can really find out easily in a quantifiable manner what's going on with your automobile. You and I can get a bit of a feeling for that with the automobile in a parking lot and you drive a circle while listening to a repeater. Well, the repeater is only at one particular elevation angle near the horizon. That gives you at least one slice of the pattern of the automobile and that antenna. What is it really doing in three-dimensional space? You'd have to mount the antenna on the automobile. The automobile is in the middle of a great big parking lot. You've got instrumentation on a helicopter, and now you fly the helicopter around the automobile at various altitudes and various azimuths. If you're willing to spend for that much helicopter time, you can make some good measurements, but it's going to cost you a heap of money. Over to you, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW, the Tech Man.
Yeah, I certainly am more than well aware of all that. It's just interesting that, I haven't done much in the way of measuring gain with Yagi antennas, but certainly with mobile whip antennas, mag mounts, and other mounts, and, there's certain ones that I find preferable over others, but one thing that always amazed me was, some of the gain numbers that they came up with the antennas, and I'm not sure that 5/8 wave, 7/8 wave, half wave antennas, and even quarter wave, that it's so much the gain of the antenna that's really changing as much as it is the pattern of the takeoff angle from it and polarization. But then again, maybe those do add into the gain number. But here again, I'm not completely sure. I'm just going to pass that one back to you for clarification. KC2QIQ.
A few guys have taken a Yagi antenna, mounted on the mast of their tower in such a way that with a rotator built into the middle of the boom of the antenna, like an alliance rotator, where the mast goes through the center of the rotator, in this case it's a boom, so that now the antenna is rotatable in polarization. So the Yagi might be aimed dead north. The boom of the Yagi stays parallel to the ground, aimed dead north, but you turn on this alliance rotator, and now the antenna can rotate in polarization. And you do that while listening to a repeater. A few guys have done that experiment on various antennas, and you see something very exciting. On certain brands of antenna, as you rotate them, when the antenna is purely horizontal, and you're looking at a purely vertically polarized repeater, you'll see an extremely deep null. Other antennas, instead of a 25 dB null, you'll see a 10 dB null. And you'll say, what's going on here? What's going on is that every linear antenna is only linear in the majority of what it does. Every antenna has a little bit of elliptical polarization. You think your antenna is, all the elements and the driven element are purely parallel to the ground, and you think you've got a horizontally polarized antenna. But the way you fed the driven element, that folded dipole, that gamma match, that delta match, that T match, whatever you did with the folded dipole, and way you physically laid it out radiates a little bit of vertical polarization. That's even before you get into the chirality of the environment. When that radio signal that's horizontally polarized comes out of your ideal Yagi and it hits that slanted tree out in front and it bounces at an oblique angle off that water tower and off the building and whatever, that signal that now arrives at the other end of that communication path.
Repeater, time out.
Take your antenna off your ass.
That signal that arrives at the other end of that communication path ain't horizontal anymore. The best example I've got of that is that when I used to be traveling up to the Romare Development Center for a 2-year period of time, every single weekend, traveling back home to Long Island and back up to Utica, New York, I had on the top of my station wagon automobile a 5/8 wave mag mount on 2 meters and a horizontal square loop antenna, M-squared loop antenna. Two feed lines coming in through the shack into the automobile, a relay that I could flip back and forth rapidly between the two while I'm receiving, and I'm talking to K2TXB, the guy down in southern New Jersey when he was there. He had a moon balance antenna, 4 Yagis on 2 meters on top of a 100-foot tower, and I'm talking to Russ Pillsbury, K2TXB, southern New Jersey, while I'm traveling on the New York State Thruway going up to Albany and then over on Route 90 all the way over to Utica. I was throughout major portions of that path, 200 miles airline distance from Rush, K2TXB. Let me drop. While I'm on that path, I'm flipping back and forth between the horizontal antenna on the automobile and the vertical antenna. And he's got 4 long 2-meter Yagis on 100 feet of tower in southern New Jersey, and he's talking to me on 2-meter sideband. And we had 90% copy throughout that whole path. And I would flip back and forth between the horizontal antenna and the vertical antenna in my automobile, and there was no difference. I heard all kinds of flutter, but with sideband and the extra sensitivity, I was getting 90% copy on everything he said and everything I said. I was running a Mirage amplifier, 180 watts. He was running a kilowatt. I needed the kilowatt because I was listening to a whole lot of road noise and ignition noise of other automobiles. So he's running a kilowatt, transmitting to me. I'm running 180 watts, transmitting back to him. We had equal communication in both directions, 90% copy throughout most of that path. And when I'm on the New York State Thruway, Route 90, up above Albany, going out to the west, going to Utica, and I'm on the northern side of the Adirondack Mountains, and I'm saying to myself, how in the world, down at ground level, was that signal getting through 200 miles of all of that jazz and getting to his antenna in southern New Jersey, Tabernacle, New Jersey, I think he was in at the time. He's now moved to Florida. How in the world is that signal getting there? Was question number one that amazed the hell out of me. Question number two, how was his horizontal transmitting signal becoming vertical when it came to me? I could flip back and forth between the horizontal antenna and the vertical antenna, and there was no difference. Same amount of fade margin, same amount of flutter, same amount of signal strength. Until I stopped at one of these high mountaintop locations. You had a couple of places on the New York State Thruway. Let me drop. You had a couple of places on the New York State Thruway where you could pull off and you get a scenic overlook.
Repeater.
You get a scenic overlook when you've got a 40-mile range. When I'm in one of those scenic overlooks, the horizontal signal was 15 dB stronger than the vertical signal. But when I was down at the roadbed, transmitting through all of those trees and buildings and water towers and everything else, the polarization became thoroughly random. So the word polarization, no antenna has pure polarization. They're all a little bit elliptical, even though you think it's linear. And even if your antenna is perfectly linear, when it reflects off the stuff in your environment, it becomes something else. You can prove this to yourself. Take an ordinary face mirror, lay it on the table in front of you, and you got a guy on the other side of the table, and you look at him in that mirror. You'll see the guy in the mirror upside down. That you understand. Pick up the mirror and hold it to your left-hand side. Hold it at the right direction so that you can see him in the mirror. When it's side, and you'll see the man in the mirror, exactly right side up, but he's reversed left to right. His left hand is his right hand, his right hand is his left hand. So the mirror replaces things in, changes things in left to right polarization when it's off to one side. It changes things up and down in polarization when it's on the table. What happens if you put it halfway between the two? If you now put the mirror slightly below you and slightly to the left, and you look at your friend, in the mirror, the friend will be lying horizontal, even though he's perfectly up and down. A simple one-bounce reflection at a crazy angle will take a horizontal signal and make it a pure vertical signal. Ain't that crazy? That's called chirality. The environment can take polarization on one bounce and make it any polarization you want, and after it bounces off 40,000 trees over that 200-mile path and can sit and repeat it. Time out. And that signal gets shifted by those trees, those buildings, and everything else. There ain't no polarization left. How it got there, I was amazed, and the polarization was very random. So, in the case of a GTAP, which is capable of giving you a very pure linear polarization in that testing environment, yes, you can measure how much horizontal, vertical, where's the deep nodes, how much elliptical polarization. You can measure that characteristic of an antenna. In a real good antenna testing anechoic chamber, the way you measure axial ratio, that's what's called. How pure is the circular polarization out of your antenna? It's called AR, axial ratio. The way they measure it is you put the antenna at one end of the chamber and you transmit with the antenna. At the other end of the antenna, at the other end of the antenna range, you take a pure linear polarized feed horn, standard gain feed horn, that's mounted on a rotary joint. And you rotate that feed horn. And you rotate the feed horn 360 degrees every, let me pick a number, 5 seconds. And you're running a strip shot recorder. So the sensing antenna, let me drop. The sensing antenna is a pure linear antenna continuously being rotated while you're running a strip shot recorder. The antenna under test is on a turntable, and it's slowly being rotated in azimuth or elevation, depending on whether or not you're doing a cardinal cut in the elevation plane or the azimuth plane, E-plane or H-plane, as they say it. And when you look at that resultant plot, it's got a very characteristic curve to it. A real good circular polarized antenna, when you're looking at it at boresight, can have a very low axial ratio. In other words, it can be very pure in circular polarization. But 98% of all the antennas, when you look at them not at boresight, you look at them 45 degrees off from boresight in either azimuth or elevation, that 2/10 of a dB axial ratio you had at boresight becomes a 20 dB peak-to-valley ratio plot when you're off to one side. So when you look at those plots, they've got a very characteristic, great big wiggle to them on the left side and the right side of boresight, and in the center, it becomes a fairly smooth plot. And all of this is superimposed on a Gaussian-shaped curve. Many an antenna has an antenna pattern just like that. A cavity-backed spiral, circular polarized log periodic, conical log periodic antennas, many of them have that kind of a characteristic. So when it comes to measuring the gain, polarization, polarimetry characteristics, axial ratio of an antenna, or you can have a grand old time with the right kind of instrumentation. I know we're off to one side on this one, John, but still it's good information, and we amateurs are extremely good at building and testing antennas, and therefore I think it's a good subject to mention once in a while. KC2WGB, KQRIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB, you're absolutely right, Dick. Antennas, you know, that's where it starts. So the more information we have on it, the better. I think we better go over to Paul now, because it's getting late, and I know Wesley wants to get in and discuss his options. So back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Okay, there's a lot more to those subjects than you've heard so far, as you can tell. And Paul, I'm a little bit worried now about Kepler. I think Kepler, I've been hearing, is in the safe mode because its second inertial motor. These inertial wheels that do the orientation.
Yes.
Mist, or what it's called, they're trying to hold the pointing of the Kepler telescope to the nearest 009-second of arc, as I remember. It's a little bit wider than a human hair viewed at the distance of the moon. That's the accuracy at which they want to hold the telescope pointing, so that when it can see that extremely gentle change in starlight as a planet goes in front of that star, and they're looking for very small changes in the starlight, because the planet is very small compared to the star, in order to make that accurate measurement, the telescope's got to be held very accurately. And now that they've lost that inertial wheel, I think whether or not they're going to be able to recover from that is an interesting subject. WS2S, K2RIW, go ahead, Paul. Make a brief transmission, Paul. You may have to go to the eastern input. WS2N, K2RIW. You want to make a trial transmission, Paul, see how it's coming through? By the way, any of you guys that are hearing a signal that you think shouldn't be there, like from our jammer, please go to the reverse mode on your rig and listen to how strong that signal is. Once we know where you're located and how strong the signal is, it'll help us locate this guy. And you may have to not only go to the reverse mode, but if your rig has got a all-mode capability, single sideband mode, because the signal in many cases is quite weak, he's intentionally done that, you may have to go to the single sideband mode and listen to the tone and the noise to find out how strong he is. But once you find that signal strength, we'd like you to report it to Limark by going to the website of RFI, Radio Frequency Interference, rfi@limark.org, limarc.org. So report the signal strength and the timing. In other words, what hour of the day you heard it, how strong it was on the reverse mode of your rig, particularly in the sideband mode, and report that to rfi@limark.org. Make a trial transmission poll and see how well you're coming through. You might have to use the eastern input. WS2N, K2RIW. Are you there, Paul?
Copy, WS2N.
When you said copy WS2N, on that transmission you were good, Paul. Go ahead.
Okay, what's the question, Dick?
You're going to tell us the space report. WS2N, space report, we're ready. Take your eyes on you. Go ahead, Paul.
Good, I'm tuning in between repeaters, so there you go. Yeah, Dick, not really that much. You do have a launch this coming Tuesday, not from the United States, but from Kazakhstan. We're going to launch three astronauts to the International Space Station for a 6-month stay. They'll be staying all around November. You got one American on board, Karen Nyberg. She's been up before. And two Russians. So they'll complement the International Space Station group. They'll go from 2 to 6.
You're coming through quite well, Paul. Don't worry.
The last cruise, Expedition 35, came back about a week or so ago. And with Chris Hatfield on board, he was the first Canadian commander. We've always had an American commander and a Russian commander. Well, he was from Canada. I'll be driving. Canada. The other guy, how they felt about having a Canadian, although I don't hit up tonight. A Canadian commander aboard the space station. I mean, they've done a lot of work, the Canadians, with the robotic arm. They built the robotic arm for the space shuttle, and they built the robotic arm for the International Space Station. They're very much involved with the that whole project, along with 15 other countries. So I thought that was interesting, and I thought I'd bring up a space launch that occurred this morning, which was the WGS-5 satellite. That communications satellite was for the Air Force that was launched by the Delta rocket from Barber. And that's being sent up to geosynchronous orbit. And 13,000 pound satellite. What I like about it is they're using the Delta rocket. Eventually the Delta rocket will be ganged up with, it'll be like three and one. And they're going to call that the Delta Heavy. They've launched it before, one time from Vandenberg, California. And eventually, they'll do the same thing in Florida. And they're going to use the unmanned Orion spacecraft. Let me drop it. Going up actually next year, the end of next year. They're going to test out the it's a regular Orion spacecraft similar to what they'll eventually use for manned flight, but they want to test out the heat shield and all this, send it out to 3,600 miles above the Earth, and then let it come back, and they're going to see how that heat shield holds up. And then a bunch of other stuff they want to test, you know, they get sensors all over. Eventually, that will all lead to a manned flight back in, let's see, probably 2017. And when they do that, they won't use the Delta Heavy, they'll just be, SLS. They'll probably use the Delta Heavy probably for some of the missions, but the SLS, the Space Launch System, will be the main for that. For the launching of the Orion spacecraft. A couple of few years anyway, probably 2017 or 2018. And that's pretty much it. That information on all the different space stations that have gone up in the past, but I don't know if we'll cover that. If somebody wants to talk about it. You can always reach me at spacenetreport@gmail.com. You want to discuss these things. For instance, the Chinese space station that's up there, how long it's been up there, and how long they plan on keeping it there, and what they plan on doing. Officially, we do have the Rock space station going around. Earth right now, the International Space Station, which is right now relatively small. So that's pretty much it. Kepler Space Telescope, still not fixed yet. Could be a problem with the reaction wheels out of whack there. There's four on board. They lost one a while back, and now they lost the one. Right now, I don't think it looks too good from what I've been reading. They're going to try a few things. Good news is that they have so much information that's been downloaded that will keep piling through that for the next couple of years, looking for more planets. That's really what that mission was, really a planet hunter. And you've got another mission going up called TESS, kind of like Kepler 2 going up in a couple of years, that will replace this one, but not in the same sense. That one just looked at one spot in space. It's Kepler in closer, much closer, you know, they're going to concentrate on the stars closest to it and look for planets, Earth-like planets. But getting this thing working again seems to be a problem. You know, these reaction wheels create stability. Years ago, in the old days, they used to launch satellites like Telstar and this and that. They would, you know, the whole satellite itself would spin. Well, that was okay. We had omnidirectional antennas, but then as the years went by, you had directional antennas. Now, the satellites that had to be fixed in space to take pictures of the Earth and pictures of the stars. So what they did for space for stabilization was add these reaction gyro wheels by spinning up one or the other. You could move it, you know, create the torque on the spacecraft. Point these things any way you want it. Reliably be very perfect, to what you're looking at. That's pretty much it. That's it for the space report. If you have any questions, Dick, or anybody else, I'll be here. This is WS2N.
Very fine, Paul. Let me ask you this. In the case of that Chinese satellite that's up there, is that their equivalent of the International Space Station? Does it have multiple people on board? They intend to have it up there for a while and do... microgravity and weightless experiments? Is that approximately what's happening there, Paul? When was the Chinese space station put up, and has anybody made a prediction as to how long it's likely to last? WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, that's just got a couple of more years before they deal over that. And it's only been visited by one crew so far. But they do have two docking ports. You know, you could have a crew stay on board and an unmanned supply craft come up if you wanted. It's only about 35, 40 feet long, you know, like the length of a small house, but only about maybe 14, 15 feet diameter. So it's just one module. And that was their first, they had put that up I think it was the end of 2011, what are we in, 2013, it's only been up a year and a half or so, and it's been visited by one spacecraft, three-man crew. They stayed up there for, maybe 14, 15 days or so and came back. And that's their first attempt. After this, now that was successful. Sending up multiple modules, and maybe by 2020, they'll start sending up three, four different modules, have them dock with one another, and that'll be their version of a permanent space station. So that's where they're at. There'll be another space station also, probably 2022. You got the Bigelow Corporation that plans on sending up those inflatable modules, and depending on how one that goes up about 2 years from now, stays on the International Space Station for a year or two, depending how that goes, Bigelow will be. I think that's the way to go. They're going to need the module for multiple reasons. Blow up modules, so they'll be able to connect with one another. They'll be bigger than the International Space Station as far as room goes. They'll be able to put these in lunar orbit in the future. They'll be able to blow them up, and they'll have capability of large area for mass if you want to make a trip to Mars. Provided these things hold up, they don't deflate. I mean, they're supposed to be as hot as concrete when they are inflated. As long as they get good reports, I think that could be the future of large dwelling space. You might want to go to the L5 location between Earth and Moon and set up a big space station there. And, I mean, you could do it with these inflatable modules. Outside of Las Vegas, space stations are the way to go. So I try to follow them, including the Chinese space station. Back to you there.
Now, when it comes to the Chinese space station, you said there was a crew of three. They stayed up for 15 days, and I presume all of them came back. Does that mean that the Chinese space station is not continuously being manned? That's question number one. Sounds like they intend to put it up into a high enough orbit, boost it periodically, leave it up there, and add extra modules to it. So is there an intention in the future to build it up in the direction of the International Space Station? In other words, is it going to get larger? Will there be extra people going up later? I'm pretty sure it has not been continuously manned. And where do you go to read about that one, the Chinese space station? Because that one, I don't think many of us know very much about that, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, I think you could put it Chinese space program 901. That's the designation for their manned space program. And they have about three different launch sites that, you know, throughout China. I think they put up three or four manned missions. One guy went up by himself, and another one went up, two people went up, and that was in the largest spacecraft, where you can hold three. And then finally, this last mission, which actually went to the space station, actually had three Chinese astronauts on board, the Takanauts they call them, including one of them was a woman, so I mean, that was their first woman that was put up in the space, and they went to the space station. And there's another mission planned, only one more mission planned to go to the space station. Now, and to answer your question, no, it's not permanently manned. This is a prototype. They wanted to see if it was all going to work out. And they'll be sending one more mission up to it, and then at the end of this year, planned on deorbiting that. And then they, you know, since all went well, presumably, they will send up, I don't know, I think it's 2020 or something like that. It's not around the block, but they'll be sending up other modules that will eventually interconnect, you know, two or three of them, and they'll have the properly manned space station at that time. Back to you there.
So it's been there now for going on 2 years. Three or four missions of one, two, or three people have gone there. Do they have the equivalent of a Progress ship that brings up consumables? Is it at a similar altitude of our International Space Station? Do they boost it periodically? Because anything in near-Earth orbit experiences a little bit of Earth drag, and it's therefore slowly decaying. So are they boosting it? Do they bring up materials with something like a Progress? What's your guess on some of these issues, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
They have a capability. I believe it had two ports, two docking ports. I don't think they had a... let's see, I think they might have had one... No, That's probably the Japanese. That's the H2 I'm thinking of. So no, I don't think they have a progress cargo type ship yet for it. But only one mission has gone to the space station, and that was a 3-person crew. When they first started out their space program in 2001, one person went up. Space station wasn't up yet. A few years later, 2-man crew went up. Again, no space station. A couple of years ago, they put the space station up. And I can never pronounce the name of that space station. Tiangong, I think it is. T-I-A-N-G-O-N-G. That's the name of that space station. If you want to put that in, drop it. Actually see what it looks like and how big it is. T-I-A-N-G-O-N-G. And then they have so far actually sent one spacecraft there with a three-person crew, and that included the first female Chinese taconaut, not astronaut. So there you go. And then one other mission is planned. Before they de-orbit that. Type music. WS1.
Timer 2BL repeater system.
You said one other thing, Paul. The Japanese H2. Is Japan also planning on putting up a space station? Or are they going to share their activities along those lines with the United States and or China? Somehow I don't think they're going to reach it there. So, is Japan ever planning on putting up a space station, to your knowledge? And what did you mean when you say Japan has something called the H2? Over to you, Paul, K2RIW.
Yeah, that's gone up 3 times to the space station, International Space Station. That is their, quote, progress ship. That's designed to supply materials, fuel, food, and water and scientific experiments to the International Space Station. That's their one of their contributions. Among others, they have their own modules attached to the International Space Station called Kaibo. It's actually the biggest modules that are up there. And it took 3 space shuttles to put that there. I mean, one of them is like 33 feet long. I mean, it's huge. So, Japan is heavily involved with the ISS, and they built the H2 supply spacecraft, and they launch it from Japan, and it goes to the International Space Station. They have future planned missions with the same thing, and it goes up, and they capture that with the robotic arm. I believe that they do not have autonomous docking with that. It brings up about the same amount of poundage or, you know, mass that Progress does. So that's what they have. We have 4 different spacecraft now that go to the International Space Station for resupply. Let me drop it. You have the Progress, which I don't know, it's countless. Every 3 or 4 months, it seems like one of those Progress from the Russians going up. You've got the H2 by Japan, and they've sent about 3 up. And you've got the ATV, the automatic transit vehicle, that'll launch from French Guiana in South America by the European Space Agency. And that takes a lot of mass up, about 3 times the amount of Progress every time one of those goes up. They've launched 3. There's one waiting in the wings called the Einstein spacecraft, or ATV. You get all the information on the European Space Agency version of the resupply. And that one docks with the Russian side of the International Space Station.